Sweet Sir Galahad came in through the window in the night when the moon was in the yard. Took her hand in his and shook the long hair from his neck, and he told her she'd been working much too hard. It was true that ever since the day her crazy man had passed away, the land of poets bright, she laughed and talked a lot with new people on the block, but always at evening time she cried. And here's to the dawn of their days. La la dee. It rested softly on his knee. There she dropped her smile, and there she sighed a while, told him all the sadness of those years that numbered three. Well, you know, I think my fate's belated, 'cause of all the hours I waited for the day when I'd no longer cry. Get myself to work by eight, but oh, was I born too late? Do you think I'll fail at every single thing I try? And here's to the dawn of their days. He just put his arm around her, and that's the way I found her, 8 months later to the day. Lines of a smile erased the tear tracks upon her face, a smile that could linger, even stay. Sweet Sir Galahad went down with his gay bride of flowers, the prince of the hours of her lifetime.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes The Corruption Game. Juan Cole, a professor of history and director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan, talks about U.S. government backing for corrupt dictatorships around the world. And after that, pressure cooking. Bill McKibben discusses the government's apathetic attitude towards global warming and that this forces the public to lead the fight against global warming.
From TomDispatch.com, this is TomCast. Interviews and insight from Tom Dispatch contributors for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of our post-9/11 world and a clear sense of how our global imperial system actually works. I'm Timothy McBain. Today I had the pleasure of speaking again with Juan Cole, professor of history and director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan, and author most recently of the book Engaging the Muslim World. We spoke about the U.S. government's practice of backing corrupt dictatorships, what we stand to gain or lose, and the consequences of popular revolt against those dictatorships. When you're talking about corrupt leaders and dictators in the Muslim world, do you think that they're any more corrupt than American politicians, or perhaps maybe just less adept at applying a veneer of legality to their corruption. For example, the Citizens United Supreme Court decision springs to mind for me as an example of sort of legalized corruption in the United States.
Well, there's a difference, I think, between politicians taking money to wage campaigns and politicians taking money to feather their own nests. And, of course, we have things like that in the United States. Tom DeLay is a recent famous example. But what's happening in these countries in the global south is, I think, qualitatively different in the sense that these are people who are parlaying their government positions into control of the country's resources and transferring public resources into their own private bank accounts. So, yes, the United States has enormous corruption, and indeed, you know, if you think of the financial crisis since 2008 as a form of corruption, then it dwarfs corruption in most of the world. But I think that with regard to the role of the politicians in it, it is a different kind of phenomenon.
Your article addresses the Tunisian Revolution and WikiLeaks and what it tells us about American support for corrupt dictatorships. Now, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the history of U.S. involvement and support for corrupt dictators, because this is certainly not unprecedented behavior.
It has a history. The United States was not a world power until really World War II. And in the wake of World War II, we had the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And the Cold War with the Soviet Union became an excuse for everything. So did we want to overthrow a country? Well, the people we were overthrowing were tilting towards international communism. Did we want to back a dictator? Well, he was keeping the communists down. So it made for very bad policy. And my argument is that that excuse for bad diplomatic behavior collapsed in 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union, but it was resurrected in the wake of the attacks of 2001, now with regard to Muslim radicalism. So the military aid that the U.S. gave to Tunisia, which admittedly wasn't a huge amount, nevertheless was being given explicitly on the grounds that that regime stood between the West and al-Qaeda, which frankly is silly.
Yeah, and the arguments that they're making to support decisions on behalf of the war on terror, like you point out, do echo the domino theory arguments of the Cold War. The thing is, the popular narrative now is, although it took decades and we had to do some unsavory things, we won the Cold War. We stopped the communists from taking over the world and forcing us to starve and not letting us celebrate Christmas and all that. Do you think that Washington believes that this will be the legacy of the war on terror eventually?
Well, Washington is a status quo power. It likes the world the way it is for the most part. So as long as things don't go south, Washington will keep proclaiming that it's winning. But I don't think we can make our social analysis on that basis. The question is what harm is done, both to the United States and to local populations by these policies. And I point out that among the biggest headaches for the United States at the moment is the Islamic Republic of Iran. But there's this kind of dialectical process whereby the United States intervened in Iran, quite unnecessarily, on behalf of the big oil companies in 1953 to put the Shah back on the throne, then supported him to the hilt, trained his secret police in torture methods. And when he was overthrown in 1978-79 by a popular revolution, of course, it was the United States that was blamed and so has had bad relations with the Iranian regime ever since. And the United States' position in the Middle East and in Central Asia was much weakened by the Iranian Revolution, which in some ways was a direct outcome of U.S. policy. So, the real question is, are these policies producing goods for the United States, and what effect are they having on local people? And in the case of support for the Shah, it was bad all around.
Are there any situations that it's possible that you could make an argument saying that we can justify these actions and the possible negative consequences because in order to protect our interests, we have to get our hands dirty? It's the cost of doing business.
Well, that's a very favored form of discourse in Washington. And of course, the CIA Directorate of Operations would talk that way, and hardliners in the State Department and the Pentagon would dismiss my argument as naive. And of course, I understand policymakers are dealing with the real world. And you know, Henry Kissinger famously said that in diplomacy you have to play with the pieces on the board. But there are some things that you just don't have to do, and doing them is counterproductive. So you don't have to support Indonesian massacres against the Christians of Timor. You just don't have to do that. And if you're doing it because you think that the Indonesian regime is standing between you and international communism, then your foreign policy is really being governed by this kind of one-size-fits-all international conspiracy theory. And that's not a way to make good policy.
Yeah, and at the end of your article, you write that there should be a middle path between overthrowing governments on one hand and backing odious dictatorships on the other. What is that middle path that you envision, and where does it fall on the spectrum between idealism and feasibility, playing with the pieces on the board?
Well, one of the things the United States does for friendly regimes is to train their troops, and to train them specifically in counterterrorism techniques, precisely the kind of techniques that are most useful for repressing civilian crowds and civilian activists. And we just shouldn't do that. If a country has really bad human rights policies, then we ought not to be helping their secret police and their army to repress people. We should just cut them off. We're not required to do this, and we have, you know, cut people off. We have cut regimes off because we don't like their policies. Nothing bad happens to us when we do that, and we benefit from dissociating ourselves from the odious. And I'm arguing that we're often stampeded, the United States is often stampeded into making bad policy, giving kinds of support to these regimes that it simply doesn't have to, by these paranoid fears, some of which are hyped, and they're hyped by companies that would like to get in there and make money training secret police. So I think the United States should just step back in the wake of the Tunisian uprising and ask itself whether that support for Ben Ali was wise, and what long-term foreign policy outcome there will be from the U.S. going around the world always backing the Ben Alis to the hilt.
To read Juan Cole's article, The Corruption Game, What the Tunisian Revolution and WikiLeaks Tell Us About American Support for Corrupt Dictatorships in the Muslim World, please visit tomdispatch.com. You can also read Juan's blog, Informed Comment, Thoughts on the Middle East, History, and Religion, at juancole.com. I'm Timothy McBain, and until we meet again, thanks for listening.
that she really done me. Ooh, she done me. She done me good. I guess nobody ever really done me. Ooh, she done me. She done me good.
TomDispatch.com. This is TomCast. Interviews and insight from Tom Dispatch contributors for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of our post-9/11 world and a clear sense of how our global imperial system actually works. I'm Timothy McBain. This week I had the pleasure of speaking with author, educator, environmentalist, and founder of 350.org, Bill McKibben, about his recent Tom Dispatch article, "We're Hot as Hell and We're Not Going to Take It Anymore." The anger that you're expressing in this piece has come from over two decades of working to try to fight the causes of climate change. Why isn't there this anger in the political world, in mainstream media, and is it surprising?
Oh, I don't know whether it's surprising or not. I just think that the time has come where we have to speak plainly about the problem that we're facing. You know, climate change is happening and happening very quickly in places all around the world, including right here at home. We're in the hottest year we've ever faced, in the end of the hottest decade we've ever come through. We've got to finally get to work, and the fact that our political system refuses to do so is troubling in the extreme. And pretending that it's not so doesn't seem to be helping. So let's actually say what the trouble is, that the planet is warming up, say what we need to do, disrupt the business model of the fossil fuel industry, and see if we can rally enough people to make that happen.
Last winter, it seemed that the only people that were pointing out the absurdity of this were people like Jon Stewart, but he noted that on a lot of mainstream media, they were giving a platform to people who were arguing, because it's snowing in D.C., there must not be global warming. But I didn't hear anybody saying this summer, oh, because it's really hot, I guess global warming is really a fact we're going to have to deal with.
Look, there's no getting around the fact that the other side, the side of the fossil fuel industry and the side of climate denialism, has its own TV network at Fox, and that is a useful thing to have, and that the rest of the media has been stuck in this kind of weird false balance for 20 years, even though science has long since figured out what's going on. We got to stop waiting for the media to do the job and start doing it ourselves with real organizing. That's what we do at 350.org. Hopefully we'll be able to build that movement bigger and stronger.
And as far as the tools that you use to organize, can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We use art and music. We use political anger. We used the Internet. Last year in October, we coordinated what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history, 5,200 separate demonstrations in 181 countries. This October, we're heading for a global work party with actions all over the world designed to not only do good things in local communities, like put up solar panels or lay out bike paths, but also to send a pointed political message to our leaders. We're getting to work. What about you?
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? Because you do mention it in your article, setting an example for the politicians.
Yeah, I'm afraid that the time has come to, if nothing else, shame these guys a little bit for not getting to work. And one way to do that is to demonstrate what work looks like. We'll be spending the weekend with shovels and hammers in our hand, and when the end of the day comes, we will put down the shovel or the hammer and pick up the cell phone and place the call, and maybe the kind of angry call to our senators, congressmen, kings, politburos, whatever it is we have, wherever we are around the world, saying, look, we're hard at work, time for you to do the same.
And along with pressure from the public and pressure from organized movements, I think often historically we see politicians don't really act on something unless there is a huge disaster. But, you know, the oil spill is a good example, saying, oh, deep oil drilling is safe until it goes wrong, and then they say, now we need legislation to stop it.
Well, things have already gone wrong with climate change. The Arctic has melted. We learned last week that the ocean has half the plankton it used to. These are pretty big disasters. Yeah, some of them are pretty visible. I mean, you look at the Earth from outer space, and it looks different than it did even 5 years ago, because there's 25% less ice up north. I mean, things are changing with enormous speed and really disconcerting speed. I hope we don't wait for something much bigger than that.
So if the pressure does work and Congress does decide to act and start introducing legislation to curb emissions and to try to turn things around, given how long it takes to get these kind of laws passed and how rapidly our environment is changing, do you think even if they started now, we would have enough time?
I don't know. We're cutting it very close. There are scientists who think we've waited too long to get started. Clearly, we're not going to stop global warming. It's already warmed a degree. There's about another degree in temperature increase coming from carbon we've already emitted. The question now is whether we're going to be able to stop there, or whether the temperature is going to increase 5 or 6 or 7 degrees this century, as climatologists have warned is likely. 2 degrees will be miserable. 7 degrees may be impossible. So we have great incentive to get to work.
One thing that I find curious is that during the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, people like Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Rice frequently invoked images of ticking time bombs and mushroom clouds to justify horrendous acts of extraordinary rendition, torture, bombings. But that was an imagined threat. Now we face a very tangible threat, the ticking time bomb of climate change, but we don't hear that same rhetoric of urgency coming from the White House or the media. Why is that?
Yeah, look, this is all hard for people to visualize because it's invisible and it happens everywhere at once and it's slow, at least compared to sort of fast-breaking things like bombs going off. And it may be that it's impossible for us to wrap our imaginations around it in a way that will really allow us to do anything. We're going to try our best at 350.org to make that imagination, that imaginative leap. We'll see if we can do it. Maybe we can be as successful as Dick Cheney in that regard.
Well, Bill, I really appreciate you speaking with me.
My pleasure. Take care, man.
To read Bill McKibben's article, "We're Hot as Hell and We're Not Going to Take It Anymore, 3 Steps to Establish a Politics of Global Warming," visit tomdispatch.com. To learn more about what you can do to help combat global warming and find information about the International Day of Action that will take place on October 10th, visit billmckibben.com or 350, that's 350.org. I'm Timothy McBain, and until we meet again, thanks for listening.
Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. And will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them that I won't be long, and they'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. we'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Yeah, we'll meet again. I don't know where, and I don't know when, but I do know that we'll meet again some sunny day. So honey, keep on smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. And would you please say hello to all the folks that I know, and tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song.
We'll meet again, don't know where,